Is that going to solve all the revenue problems?
Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. Thank you very much for being here on a bright and early Monday morning. We have four bills that are scheduled for public hearing and possible work sessions. Let me just walk through the three that are 2356A, 2557A, and 2596A will only be public hearings. We do not have all the paperwork, and some of them need to be married as to dealing with the same subject. With that said, what we're going to go ahead and do and open up a public hearing on 2557A since Representative Greenlick's here. And Eric, why don't you give us an overview?
Chair Brzozinski, members of the committee, House Bill 2557A comes to this committee from Senators Gelser, Representative Greenlick, Representatives Barnhart, Frederick, Vega Peterson, and Williamson. The bill authorizes the court to set aside findings of guilty or responsibility except for insanity. It establishes a criteria and process. It adds the Psychiatric Security Review Board, the Department of Human Services, and the Oregon Health Authority to certain definitions that apply the exception to juvenile case records. There's one technical cleanup amendment before the committee, the Dash A2 amendment, which clarifies that medical records in the possession of the PSRB or the Oregon Health Authority are not to be sealed following a successful motion to set aside. I do anticipate another amendment. There's no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
All right. Mitch, thank you for being here. Why don't you go ahead and get started? Might have a question regarding the amendments once we get through your preliminary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sure I'm not the right one to answer the question on the amendment, but I believe okay. PSRB is here.
Okay.
This is a matter of simple justice, it seems to me. If somebody is convicted of a crime, they have the opportunity after 10 years of good life and a variety of other things to ask for their crime to be expunged. If somebody was found guilty except for insanity or responsible except for insanity for exactly that same crime, there's no avenue for them to be able to ask for expungement. All this bill does is it ties GEI and REI to exactly the same set of crimes and allows the person adjudicated to be GEI or REI to ask for expungement and under the same conditions, the same period of time, and the same good behavior. We've worked with PSRB with this in the beginning. They're very supportive. And that's actually all I have to say.
You did great, except for one thing.
I didn't introduce myself.
That's correct.
I'm State Representative Michigan. It just came to me that I didn't remember doing that.
If I didn't catch Michigan. It earlier, I would have said something, but that just shows it is a Monday morning. All right. Thank you very much. Questions for the representative? Mitch, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr.
I've got
Speaker.
Three individuals that have signed up for giving testimony on 2557A. Lucy Hill, Bob Juntef, and Gail Meyer. Why don't the three of you please come forward? While they're coming up, let me ask if there's anyone else who will want to give testimony on House Bill 2557A. And I'm going to let you, whoever wants to present first, go ahead. And then I also would like to know if the Dash 2s belong to either any of you, and if so, who, and give us a little bit of background on the Dash 2s.
Good morning, Chair Brzozinski, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee. My name is Lucy Heil. I am the policy analyst and program manager for the Psychiatric Security Review Board. House Bill 2557 provides an opportunity for those who are found guilty or responsible, except for insanity, of certain offenses to request expungement under certain conditions. This bill is intended to allow those individuals, as Representative Greenlick indicated, who are healthy and stable in their recovery, who have little, if any, prior criminal or GEI history, to request removal of the GEI or REI finding that exists in their criminal history. It is analogous, as, again, Representative Greenlick indicated, to the statutory provision found in ORS 137.225 that allows for expungement of criminal convictions. If certain clients are doing well for an extended period of time, the GEI finding or arrest in their criminal histories can cause significant barriers to their housing and employment opportunities, even after a substantial period of time has elapsed. This particular bill allows those who are found GEI or REI, who have remained in compliance for a substantial period of time, who have followed orders, and who have been discharged from the board, the opportunity to then later try to return to communities as positive employed homeowners, and this may be a substantial motivating force for those people. The court order setting aside the GEI or REI findings under this proposed bill will only be allowed to occur under strict and clearly articulated circumstances. The PSRB, as well as Disability Rights Oregon, have been working closely on some clarifying language about the board's record handling responsibilities under this bill, and understand that the proposed amendment before you is in the works and perhaps may be amenable, if you will, to revision or fine-tuning. But the aim, I think Mr. Junduff will address, is for certain medical records to later be available for those who might down the road need additional treatment. And so for those records to be able to be used by treatment teams and those who are helping the individuals, we believe that those circumstances will be very few and far between, very infrequent. Thank you for allowing me this opportunity to speak in front of you today. And unless you have any questions for me, I will turn it over to Mr. Junduff.
What we're going to do, we'll take the whole panel, then we'll open up for questions.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Bob?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Junduff. I'm from Disability Rights Oregon. House Bill 2557 is a bill that's really recognizing a few realities of the insanity defense area. And one is that there are people who can come under the PSRB or the state system because of the use of an insanity defense. And it can be a one-time type of situation, and it can be a crime that is of a lower level. It can be a misdemeanor or a very low-level felony. And those individuals have every incentive in the world, of course, to engage in treatment and to get better and to return to society. When there is a label on a person, I'll use the term criminally insane, you might imagine that there's a significant social stigma to that label. And when a person has been through this process, that is the label that they carry. There is an important social goal of having people continue to engage in treatment if they need it and be able to be productive in work, find housing, and live full lives, having gone through the types of restorative treatment and care that the state has provided for those people. And that's what House Bill 2557 recognizes. Mm-hmm. And we fully support it. Let's get to the amendments. The A2 amendments are trying really in our mind to clarify that the goal here is not to eliminate medical records that a person may have compiled during their periods of treatment. In fact, those records may be very important for them when they if they need psychiatric care in the future, or they come within our psychiatric system. There was some concern by the folks at the state hospital as well as the PSRB that if a person did come back into those systems, that those records would not be available as a result of this bill. This was not the intent of the bill to begin with. Our sense is that as in a traditional criminal expunction process, medical records would not be affected. And we checked that out with the Department of Corrections, that they do not seal medical records. But in order to allay any concerns about that, we wanted to make sure that it was clear that medical records were not sealed as a result of this bill. There was an additional concern from the PSRB that other types of reports that have to do with a person's medical treatment might also be unavailable to them if they might need them in the future in order to address a person's care needs. We're not sure exactly here at DRO, we're not exactly sure about those reports because we were concerned that somehow they might become public and be used for other purposes. But we were assured by the PSRB that these are confidential records and that they would remain confidential within the PSRB and not be available for access outside their agency. With that understanding, we agreed to the full terms of this amendment. The very important part of this bill is that the public, landlords, employers, others who come into contact with folks in their daily lives would not, upon the records being sealed, would not have access to those records except under the most limited circumstances that are outlined in the bill. And with that, we are in agreement with the amendment. Lastly, there is an additional amendment out there that has been raised, some concerns about wording in the bill. Those concerns make perfect sense. The wording needs to be adjusted. It wouldn't affect the intent or the application, as we see it, of the legislation. And so we would be in agreement with changes that have been proposed to clarify the intent of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Gail?
Thank you. Chair Przonski, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, giving our full support to House Bill 2557. I don't have much to say other than what's already been stated, except to note that those who do walk around with conviction history find it very, very difficult to move on in life. And so the opportunity, the window to expunge certain adjudications, convictions can be life-changing and reforming in and of itself. As to the amendments, the A2, the record part of it, I cannot speak to it because the truth of it is I don't consider myself with the expertise, as does Mr. Junduff. As to the additional amendment that's yet to forthcome, that is a language change, we've reviewed that and we agree with it. Happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you. Questions?
Yes.
Senator Thatcher.
I'm not real clear on what crimes are the certain crimes that are allowed under this bill.
Chair Przonski, Senator Thatcher, this is intended to parallel the eligibility of the on the conviction side of life, and so it's not any broader than that. Generally, as a basic rule, let me just say the expungement statute has been amended so many times, we now call it a Frankenstein, and we've been attempting to de-Frankenstein that statute, but it's been modified many times. By basic structure, it's a C felony or a misdemeanor that is eligible to be set aside with exceptions. And the exceptions generally relate to sex crimes cannot be expunged except for a very narrow, teeny set of circumstances. Certain crimes of violence cannot be expunged. And so what 2557 does is simply parallel tracks the conviction side. It doesn't expand upon the eligibility of the crime.
In other words, if the person went through the regular criminal justice system and was convicted of whatever those crimes are, those are the ones that, if they could be expunged on the criminal side, they could also be expunged through this process.
That's correct, Chair Przonski, yes.
All right. All right, and I thank you, Bob, for putting on the record as to what the dash two is. I wanted it on the record as to why we wanted to ensure the records, the medical records, were still available. It makes very obvious sense that you don't want to start from ground zero. You should have that baseline of whatever it was before. All right. Any other questions or comments?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Did I understand correctly that you thought the dash two still needed some work to refine them, or... And if they do, what do you think needs to be done?
Chair Przonski, Senator Burdick, our feeling is that the dash twos are fine as is, as long as it is clear, and we believe it is, that all of the records that are accepted in the dash twos are confidential and cannot be released to the general public. and that the only release of any of the records that are sealed are covered in other provisions of the bill already. As long as there's that understanding, we're fine with the dash twos.
So just let everyone, as a reminder, we're not moving this bill today because we are waiting for some other paperwork, and we're also not going to be moving 2356 or 2596 because they're going to deal with the same issues, and then we're going to somehow marry them together. So with that, thank you all very much for coming forward. And I'll ask once again, since a few people have come in the room, is there anyone else who wants to give testimony on House Bill 2557A? Not seeing anyone come forward, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on that bill. And we'll open up a public hearing. We're going back up to the top of the agenda for 23. No, we're not. There's no one signed up there. So why don't we go with opening up a public hearing on House Bill 2356A as well as 2596A.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, House Bill 2596A comes to this committee from Representatives Buckley, Olson, and Hack. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact. The bill modifies the crime of invasion of personal privacy to prohibit the non-consensual recording of another person's intimate areas. House Bill 2356A incorporates that same concept with some slightly different wording that needs to be worked out. In addition, it modifies the invasion of privacy statute to include two degrees of offenses, invasion of privacy in the first degree, which would apply to recidivists and those who make recordings of others, and then invasion of privacy in the second degree would remain a misdemeanor. That bill has been given a subsequent referral to Ways and Means based on the fiscal impact. So there's some conflict amendments that need to be worked out. They're not ready to move.
Okay. And then did you give us the 1096, the summary?
I did.
Okay. All right, so I have, looks like, six people who have signed up for the two bills. I've got a group that want to talk about 2356, so I'm going to bring you all up first. And I don't know, is it Dency?
Denise.
Denise, please come forward. Kathy McAnis, Ashley Buckle, and Kelsey Evers. We'll need a fourth chair, please. Ladies, thank you very much for being here. Whoever would like to start off, if you give us your name before your testimony, that would be great.
Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. I'm Denise Bowles, and I'm from Salem, Oregon. House Bill 2356 was drafted while I was serving as state representative for House District 19. These ladies here are members of this community, and there was a situation that transpired, and they will share more specifically their story. But real quickly, I just wanted to say that this past fall, Ashley's stepfather was charged with burglary, stalking, and invasion of privacy in both Marion and Benton counties. There were seven victims in this case. He left a hidden camera in bathrooms, bedrooms of these women, and stored the images on a thumb drive. He is spending nearly 4 years in prison, but not for secretly videotaping these girls, but because he was charged and convicted of burglary. There are 3 counts of burglary and 14 counts of invasion of privacy in Ashley's case alone. There are also recent cases in Happy Valley and in Beaverton that have been in the news in the last 6 months. Currently in Oregon, a conviction of invasion of privacy, regardless of the age of a victim, is a misdemeanor. I introduced this bill in order to move Oregon's laws forward in an attempt to keep up with rapidly developing technology. I started this process with Ashley and her mother, Kathy, Ashley's friends and roommates. But since then, I've been contacted from people from all over the state of Oregon thanking me for introducing this legislation and advocating for its passage. I have heard from victims, family members, and private citizens who are really, frankly, surprised to know that that girls, men, women, you know, can be secretly videotaped for years and not receive punishment, really, that is appropriate for the crime that's been committed. People that intentionally place hidden videos in bedrooms and bathrooms and capture those images forever, that's what this bill is addressing. This would make an invasion of privacy a Class C felony if the person has a prior conviction of one of several specifically defined crimes or if the victim is a minor. It also allows for discretionary sex offender registration. Changing the classification of a crime is significant, and it should be. We are a nation of both justice and mercy. This should be evident in our criminal justice system. This crime needs to be reclassified. The predatory nature, the sexual distinctions, and the potential image longevity of this crime should be reflective in its classification. I don't believe the current classification of a misdemeanor, regardless of the victim's age or circumstances, provides the appropriate accountability for the offender or justice for the victim. With increasing technology, Oregon's current statute is inadequate to address this crime. Once captured, these images have the potential to be in cyberspace forever. The victim's privacy is not simply compromised in places where they should be safest, but can continue to be compromised in the future. I just urge your support for this bill and wanted to remind the committee that this is passed out of the House 60-0. We had some strong support, and I think this is a very straightforward, appropriate solution to provide some justice for these victims. Thank you.
Thank you. Who'd like to go next?
Members of the committee, for your record, my name is Ashley Buckle, and I live in Kaiser, Oregon. Most of you have heard my story. Brian Tilley, my ex-stepfather, secretly filmed me and other women in our bedrooms and bathrooms. My ex-stepfather is now in prison, but not for filming me and me and other women, but for stalking me and breaking into homes. Our current system lacks justice and accountability to these predators that commit invasion of personal privacy. Currently in the state of Oregon, the law allows someone to enter your home, place a camera in your bedroom and bathroom, videotape you without your permission. Then they can retrieve this camera, view and use these videos however they wish, and not be charged on a crime, only a misdemeanor. These videos are now in cyberspace forever for anyone to view, only if the predator gets caught. Why is it okay to film someone in their bedroom and bathroom without a person's consent and it not be a criminal act? It is sad that this person is not held accountable for the crime they have committed. Not knowing where these videos could be is very destructive to a person's life. It's been destructive to my life. I now have to be in fear not knowing how many videos there are, but also where these videos might be and where they could reappear. I deserve my privacy in my own bedroom and bathroom without having to be fearful for my privacy. This crime is so violating. It's hard to put in words or even describe how painful it is to be secretly filmed. Then on top of being violated, it's painful knowing I'm not protected by the Oregon laws. I would like to see a change in Oregon. I would like to see a change in invasion of personal privacy change from a misdemeanor to a felony. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. We'll take all the testimony, and then we'll ask if there's any questions. Okay. Who's next?
Domingo Kelsey.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Good morning, members of the committee and Chair Brzozinski. I hope I pronounced that right. For your record, I reside in Kaiser, Oregon, and I am here to represent my daughter and other women and children in the state of Oregon. Our women and children deserve respect in the privacy of their own homes.
And I need you to put your name on the record, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot my name.
You're doing great.
Thank you. I am Kathy McGinnis.
Thank
sorry.
You.
Thank you. When did we stop respecting a person's right to privacy? For example, it should be safe for a person to enter a public restroom, a dressing room, a doctor's office, in our own homes, without being filmed and their personal privacy being taken away. In the state of Oregon, we should have the right to be protected from predators and not be abused by invasion of personal privacy. Our laws are not currently available video technology and do not protect our women and children. We need to work together to respect and support our women and children from predators, from committing these crimes and having no legal repercussions for their predator behavior. Our laws need to be changed. Let's work together to make this happen and create personal safety for our Oregonians. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today.
Thank you. And Kelsey.
Yeah.
Members of the committee, my name is Kelsey. I'm from Kaiser, and I'm here today to tell you why I think the laws regarding invasion of personal privacy need to change. It was unbelievable for me to find out that placing a camera in a person's home without their consent is only a misdemeanor in the state of Oregon. With the current law, an individual can enter a home, place a camera in any desired location, film a victim, and then retrieve that camera. With that video, they can do whatever they please. We have no idea where these videos can end up or what he or she will do with those videos. They could be roaming around the internet for all eyes to view. Not to mention, the individual does not have to register as a sex offender if he or she gets caught. The current law does not even protect the victim. I feel very strongly that the law needs to be changed because although I have not been personally a victim of this crime, I am very close with others that have been, and I have seen firsthand the pain, fear, and devastation that it has brought. In several cases also, the people taking the videos are not strangers. In fact, they're usually people you know quite well and would least expect. It's very clear that this crime could also happen to anyone. Invasion of personal privacy needs to be changed to a felony, and the perpetrators should be required to register as a sex offender. Although this law will not affect situations that have happened in the past, we feel strongly that needs to be changed so that people are not left in the same situation that many of us face today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, questions? Senator Thatcher?
No question, but I'm so glad you came forward, and boy, it just seems like a no-duh. Really should change. Thanks.
Thank you all very much for coming forward and sharing your personal stories.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Next panel is going to be Laurie Wimmer and Dana Lovejoy.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. For your record, Laurie Wimmer, representing 42,000 members of the Oregon Education Association, here in support of House Bill 2596A, which we requested to close gap in our laws relating to invasion of privacy, similar to the issue you just heard about, but with a slight twist. A phenomenon exists in Oregon called upskirting that involves the surreptitious recording of images of people's intimate areas using flip phones and then circulating the stolen images on social media. This humiliating and invasive behavior is a thing out there. There's a competition among teenagers especially to see who's able to capture the most such photos and post them on the internet. Not only is this behavior devastating, but it's also not illegal, particularly if this unsuspecting victim is wearing underwear, because that's not nudity. This parsing defies logic. The injustice is something that you can remedy, and that's why we ask for legislation to make both the act of capturing the image and of circulating it a crime. Because the Senate had already passed a bill related to circulating lewd images, that portion of the bill was amended out of House Bill 2596 on the House side and then passed unanimously on the House floor. And it comes to you today, and we believe that the two bills then are companions that will make certain that this phenomenon is curtailed. It's not just our members who've been victimized by upskirting. Our students are also at risk, as are other citizens, of course. This bill's been crafted to protect anyone anywhere from such intentional conduct. Now to tell you about her experience is Albany teacher Dana Lovejoy, whose courage in coming forward is truly inspiring. Thank you for considering passage.
Thank you.
Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Dana Lovejoy, and I teach at Calipuya Middle School in Albany, Oregon. I am here today in support of House Bill 2596 because I've been directly affected by the form of sexual abuse that I hope it will prevent. I would like to share with this committee my experience as it occurred in my own classroom almost a year ago. On May 22nd, 2014, I was approached by a very brave young lady suggesting that cell phones no longer be used. She was the only student with the integrity to come forward. When I asked for her reasoning, she informed me that a student in a different class had used his cell phone to take a picture under my skirt 4 days earlier and was showing it to other students. I am here today to ask for your help in stopping this kind of sexual abuse, as Oregon law does not currently classify this type of behavior as criminal. This is my experience. May 22nd was a Thursday. On Monday of that same week, I was wearing this ankle-length dress. My students sit in groups made up of 3 to 4 individuals occupying 10 tables. With over 30 students in my classroom at one time, space to move through the classroom addressing the various needs of the students is limited. At one point during my fourth period class, I stopped to assist one of my students, leaning forward slightly to do so. I had no reason to believe my body needed to be protected. Unfortunately, I was wrong. A male student sitting at the table behind me lowered his cell phone until it was almost on the floor and began taking pictures under my skirt. Several witnesses who later gave statements verified this. Once he had the pictures, he immediately Snapchatted to other individuals in the classroom and in the school district. From there, the picture was resent and shown to other students in the school and school district utilizing those students' networks. Following my class, one of the recipients was showing the picture to several classmates. This was the catalyst that prompted the brave young lady to come forward. She saw the situation and was bothered by the picture. Over the course of the days that followed, the picture ended up on other social media outlets such as Instagram. By Thursday, when the investigation began in my school, this picture had been seen by most of the students in my classes. Upon learning what had happened, I fell immediately in shock and violated. Not only was I photographed without my consent, not only was it of my genital area, but the majority of the school I work in had seen it before I knew it even existed. Upon hearing the information, I told all of my students that their cell phones needed to remain in their lockers. Very few students protested or asked why, because, as I now know, they knew exactly what had happened. I contacted the office to ensure the incident was under investigation. My principal subsequently informed me where he was with the investigation. Not surprisingly, he couldn't get a confession out of the student, and the photo was no longer on his phone. After confirming with me that I had underwear on, the principal went on to say the violation of my person was not criminal due to the fact that I had underwear on and my intimate areas were not completely exposed. And in spite of the fact that there were witnesses who confirmed the young female's story, without the picture, it was going to be hard to hold the perpetrator accountable. According to current law, no crime was committed because I had underwear on, concealing my intimate areas. According to current law, the criminal intent for this action depends on what the woman is wearing, not wearing under her skirt. This student did not care what I had on underneath my dress. His intent was the same, regardless of whether I was covered or exposed. So the criminal penalty should not be the same, regardless of how the woman is dressed. He was taking a picture of the very most private area of my body. While it was challenging to focus, I had continued to work through the school day telling each of the classes that cell phones had to remain in their lockers. I told them that I had been made aware of being violated and their privilege had been lost. In spite of the violation, I continued to be professional and work with the students, even those who were involved. A couple class periods later, the principal entered my classroom again and requested I meet with him after school for an update on his investigation. He informed me that he had called the students who were closely involved in for questioning. However, by this point, too much time had elapsed and the picture was apparently no longer on their phones. The school did find pictures on their phones of adolescent females, classmates with exposed gaps in their shirts and pants as they sat in the chairs. A lot of these pictures showed undergarments of the girls, but they too had no outlet to lodge a complaint since their body was not exposed due to the wearing of undergarments. So let me paraphrase what I just explained. An adolescent male can take inappropriate pictures of an adolescent female's genitalia, unbeknownst to her, post them on social media for others to see, but it's not criminal for him to do so as long as she is wearing undergarments. The principal, the human resources department, or the police could take no action because the incident was not criminal. I continued to suffer through the pain of being violated and to work as a professional to finish out the school year. It has been almost a year since the incident, and I'm still working to recover from the violation I feel. I now only wear dresses and skirts if I have tights or shorts underneath to protect myself from potential voyeurs. I still feel overcome with emotion and cry when I share my stories with others. I have instituted a no cell phone policy in my classroom, yet I still find students hiding them while they're in class. I no longer feel safe in my classroom. Unfortunately, this is not an isolated incident. Earlier this year, a student who transferred from another school in Oregon shared that students in his other school's class tried to take pictures under his teacher's dress last year. I tell every teacher I know about what happened to me in an effort to protect them from the same thing happening. I am not the first to have this upskirting happen, and the recent stories in the news prove that I am not the last. The fact that the action has been given a moniker is evidence that this is taking place too often and with little or no recourse for victims. Our laws have not kept up with our technology. As a result of this incident, my school district has changed its policies in relation to sexual harassment to address this type of act. However, these changes only affect the women who work in my district. Every individual has the right to reasonably expect they are protected against inappropriate acts of sexual nature. Please help us protect our teachers and our students. They are your daughters, sisters, wives, and mothers. I ask each of you to please support House Bill 2596 so this never happens again. I thank you for your time and your consideration.
All right. Thank you, Dana. First of all, for the committee, thank you very much for being so brave to come forward and publicly tell your story. I know from what I'm hearing that you've said this to other people, but I know coming before a lot of people you've never met in this capacity takes a lot of will, and thank you very much for being willing to do that. Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Ms. Lovejoy, for coming. Was there any disciplinary consequence at all for the boy that took the pictures or for the others, school-based disciplinary?
Chairman Senator Gelser, the only punishment that he received was really as a result of having a previous record. So he was in violation of probation because he got in trouble at school. But there was no, there was nothing criminal about what he did. So our school did the best they could with what they could.
But has, let me just, I was going to ask, did the school introduce a honor code situation? Because what I thought I heard you say about sexual harassment, does that include the students as well as the professionals?
Yes. So now our sexual harassment policy in our district is inclusive of student to teachers.
And just a comment I have. First of all, again, thank you for coming. I know it's a very difficult story to tell. I have three teenage daughters and follow social media and am horrified on a weekly basis by logging in and seeing the way that girls in their school are talked about and female teachers are talked about, the photos that are printed. And I know that schools really kind of have their hands tied in terms of how they can respond. I was really impressed with the principal of Corvallis High School a couple of weeks ago. There's an application called Burn Book, which I'm sure you're aware of, and they were posting intimate pictures of teenagers on on that application. The principal got on to the intercom and let the students know that there was zero tolerance for that or for bullying, harassment, and that any student that was found to be in violation of those principles would be banned from participating in graduation exercises, removed from extracurricular activities, and face an out-of-school suspension. And posting on Burn Book for that school pretty much stopped after that day. So I really appreciated his being that aggressive about saying that that's really unacceptable behavior. It really creates a hostile environment, I think, for the girls that are going to school in our middle and high schools.
Mr. Chair, are we going to have other people testify to this that might have more technical?
Well, at this point, we have no one else. I'm going to ask if anyone else is here. We are going to do work on some amendments. So what are the issues so we can make sure?
Well, I just was wondering if they mentioned that the images were no longer on the phone, and I'm wondering how a criminal conviction could be pursued. Maybe there are other ways.
Well, I mean, there's circumstantial evidence. I understand the dilemma that the school district finds themselves in, but clearly, if a case like that came to me as a prosecutor, based on having independent witnesses observing this act take place, mm-hmm. even though you don't have the direct evidence of the photograph being on the phone, even if you did, the question is, how did it get on the phone? Did he put it there based on the conduct, or was it transferred to him by someone else? But clearly, you know, from my perspective, when you got people that can actually say, as an eyewitness, this is what I saw, and you can circumstantially believe that the photograph came from that conduct. Okay. So, you know, it's unfortunate because in different jurisdictions, the resource levels are vary, and some things are pursued and some aren't. And I think if you gave it to a different prosecutor, they may have a different outlook on it.
It's true. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you all very much for coming forward. So let me ask once again, is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on either House Bill 2356A or House Bill 2596A? All right, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearings on both those bills. As I mentioned at the beginning, these two are not ready to move today. We will be working them, getting the necessary information, paperwork, and amendments as necessary, if any, and we'll decide on whether we need one or two bills or they should be put together based on knowing that one of them actually has a subsequent referral. It may be best to keep them separate so we make certain one of them makes it through if the other one seems like it's going to have a fiscal that's going to be disproportionate for what we can expect out of Ways and Means. All right, so those are closed. The last bill I have is House Bill 2341A. So I'm going to open up a public hearing on it. And I have no one that's listed here who wants to give testimony on House Bill 2341A. I'm going to have Eric go ahead and give us the overview. Looking at it, I understand why we may not have anyone, but I would have expected that we would have.
Chair Przonski, members of the committee, House Bill 2341A came to this committee from the House Interim Judiciary Committee. The bill is pretty straightforward. It authorizes the court to order extradition costs when a defendant is found in violation of his probation after leaving the state in violation of his probation, and it directs that those fees be collected and placed in a special fund, the Arrest and Return Fund. Currently, the court can order the defendant to pay extradition fees when they're convicted on the underlying offense, but that does not exist for probation violations.
All right. So does everyone understand what this bill is going to do? All right. If there are any questions.
So
go ahead, Senator.
So just to clarify, in English now. Okay. Basically, if a defendant crosses state lines just to try to escape something or for whatever reason against the whatever agreement they're under, then to get them back in the state, they would have to pay the costs in order to do that. And apparently that's a bunch of paperwork and whatnot from the other state. Is that?
Basically, what you have now, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that basically if you have someone that makes flight before conviction, they can actually have those costs applied to them at the time of judgment. These are individuals who have been convicted and they're now on probation who now leave the state and in the sense of they've made flight, I mean, it's not just leaving the state per se.
It's leaving the state in violation of your probation. You may have permission to leave the state, but if you didn't have that permission and you were therefore violating it and then arrested in the other state. Mm.
Then when they bring you back, and you got to realize that for those type of offenses, you're usually are talking about, a class A and possibly class B felonies. I mean, these are extradition from other states is not just happen on any and everything. Yeah. And so when they are brought back, then the court would have the authority to assess extradition cost if the court deemed that appropriate and went through the litany test of whether they think they could pay it or part of it or whatever. So it's kind of marrying up what can happen now on the pre-conviction side to those who are actually on probation and getting them back.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
And how are those costs determined?
The cost is determined. There would be a cost bill, more than likely, or something that would be permitted or submitted by the prosecutor in the case, stating that this much time went into the case, whether or not detectives had to be drive somewhere or fly somewhere to get the individual and bring them back. All of those costs would have to be basically itemized to some level for the court to have enough information to say what that dollar amount, and then the court would has the ability to balance and say whether it's a reasonable cost or not. I mean, clearly, if you had people flying first class, they would probably say that's not as compared to, you know, flying coach, that type of thing.
Yeah, and to add to that, we received our fiscal impact. Most of the time, I believe the state relies on this shuttle return system with buses going state to state, and they had an estimate that per offender, the average cost to Oregon was $36. So this is pretty inexpensive bus fare.
Yeah, I guess I'm going to say another thing, thinking about this being at a probation stage versus pre-conviction, you probably aren't going to have as much resource power going out of the state to get them, and they do have the shuttle system that we use in Salem and in the state for around the prisons and the jails and stuff like that. And then there's networks around the country, I'm assuming, that they tie into and they hub, and you know, it may take the person 30 or 40 days to get back. They get to see a good portion of the country depending where they're at, but that's, you know, that's the whopping cost of maybe $36. A good way to see the country, I guess, huh? All right. Any other questions, comments? I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2341A. Open the work session on House Bill 2341A.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2341A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2341A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And anyone want to carry? Going once?
Sure, why not?
No, that's the next one. All right, Senator Thatcher will be our carrier on House Bill 2341A. Thank you. All right, so that, I believe, takes care of our work for today. And we're scheduled to be back here tomorrow at 8:30. With that, we're adjourned. Thank you.